Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2026 season. I'm Greg Johnston. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging. In this series of podcasts, we'll be hearing from the winners of the ARA Historical Novel Prize 2025, both adult and CYA categories. But we'll also be hearing from some other authors of historical fiction. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a staggering $155,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories and the Reader's Choice Award. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading and writing and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. Imagining the Past is commercial free. HNSA is a volunteer-run, not-for-profit organisation and can only continue to produce the podcast with your support. Please consider making a tax-deductible donation through our secure website. All contributions, great or small, are greatly appreciated. On another dark and stormy night, Mirandi Riwo launched her new novel, A Short History of Longans, at Newtown's Better Read Than Dead. She was in conversation with Emily Maguire.
Welcome. It is my great, great pleasure to be joined here tonight with genuinely one of the very best fiction writers working in Australia today, who also happens to be an extraordinary.
Greg, was that recorded?
We are being recorded. genuinely as well, extraordinary, generous literary citizen. I think many of this in this room will know that about Mirandi, and just one of most delightful, one of my favourite people in the world. So absolute pleasure to have you here tonight.
Thank you, Mirandi. Thank you, Emily.
We are here celebrating Mirandi's exquisite new novel, A Short History of Longans. It is a sweeping story following four generations of an Irish, Chinese, Australian family across almost 200 years. I was fortunate enough to read an early copy a few months ago, and I said at the time that I knew this was going to be one of those books that I would keep thinking about long after I put it down. And that's proved absolutely true. There have been so many moments since then where bits from the book have returned to me, and it's those little stabs in the heart that is almost like I'm remembering something from my own life or something that happened to someone I love that I just find myself suddenly thinking about. It's a really strange but lovely thing that I think as a reader sometimes happens with certain characters and certain stories. And then I reread the book this week in preparation for tonight, and that feeling of being in touch again with these loved ones that I'd missed was so profound. But I also, on this second note, I noticed, you know, new connections, new details, because it's a book in which there are connections that aren't going to be immediately obvious. And I think it's a really rare thing to find a book that's both immediately immersive and memorable, but that also rewards rereading. And so it's an absolute joy to be able to introduce you all to this one tonight. There's so much to talk about. I have a lot of questions. We will have a little bit of time at the end, probably, depending on how much we yap.
Sure.
For some questions from all of you. So do keep that in mind as we talk. Let's start, Mirandi, where the book starts,
yes,
which is in 2049 with Daniel. Yes. Tell us a little bit about who he is, what's going on when we meet him.
Okay, so Daniel, it is Brisbane. I don't say it's Brisbane, but it is Brisbane. He's a recluse. It's in 2049. There's been terrible storms in winter because things have gotten a bit worse climate-wise. And he wakes up in the morning and his longan tree has been destroyed by a storm, and he's a recluse for a reason. So he kind of accepts it for what it is, and then he hasn't been used to sort of socialising with anyone, even family, for quite a while because of something that happened in his past. And a neighbour kind of tries to befriend him. And actually the Long Arm Tree was based on my dad's. My dad has a Long Arm Tree. He's mid-chew. He had a Long Arm Tree that, you know, quite a few years ago actually, a storm took it out, like this big Long Arm Tree he had in the front yard. So it was a bit sad because, you know, he'd had these trees for a long time and it was taken out by a huge storm. And that kind of, and Papa's house actually, kind of inspired Daniel's dwelling. Papa is not a recluse though. No.
He's no, here, for no. example, tonight yes. with us.
Yes, he'd like to be a recluse, yeah. but yeah. and he hasn't got something in his past so that we
yeah.
know of.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. Yeah, and it's a beautiful portrait of the recluse too, and I, not as a recluse, but as an introvert who can often spend extremely long periods on my own and not talking to anyone. I mean, again, it's these little moments throughout, often the connections with the characters, but there's a bit there where he reflects on his most used words, which are thank you, and it's he says thank you to the staff who helped him reach the corn relish at the supermarket, thank you to the woman at the hardware store where he buys glue and terps. Thanks, mate, to the young man at the bottle shop, and that idea of the only people you speak to being these sort of service professionals and this light interaction, that's the kind of thing that I find myself thinking of when I'm walking through the shopping centre and seeing someone yes. in there that's just having what might be their only interaction for that
yeah.
week.
Yeah,
and,
that's right.
And that's Daniel. We absolutely need to talk about the structure of the book, and we're going to dig into that later. Because it is a backwards chronology, which
yes.
we will come back to.
Yes.
But just for now, I'm interested in why you started this story, Daniel's story, the whole book, in the future. Not hugely in the future, but 2049. What kind of possibilities did that open up that placing him in our present couldn't do?
I guess there are a few things. I guess on the major sort of arc, I wanted it to be in 50-year, you know, increments, and it starts in 1850
yeah.
with the Irish orphan. So that kind of worked out, and it's not a climate novel, but I did want to sort of dwell on you know what it might be like. And also Daniel is much the same age as me, so where he is at in 2049 is maybe he's going to be a tiny bit older or younger. I can't remember, but it was sort of, I could be in sync with him as well in that way. So, but at heart, I did want to do it in the four seasons, 50 years going backwards for each of them, except he's older by the time. So we get to see like now and a bit past, but through his younger years. Yes.
Yes. So, as you said, you sort of move back in these increments of 50 years. So after
there was
Daniel,
so much math trying to work out, and the yes. family tree at the front.
Yes, we have one of my favorite things
my
as well in a
gosh.
Book to have that family tree in the
trying
front.
To work out. So there's a family tree, yeah. and I can't tell you. And the first one I gave them was just a drawing. I couldn't even do it on a computer. I didn't know what the hell. I tried. I did try to do family trees on the computer. Couldn't do it. So eventually, I just drew them this thing like almost with crayons and sent that in. And then it was just like, you know, I'd have to scratch out somebody's birth date and change it and like, you know, move it around for, you know, or else they were like 14 when they got married kind of thing. So, yeah, it was a lot of that actually felt very not organic. We're trying to work out
yeah.
all the years.
Yeah. yeah.
and, you know, how old is Daniel and, yeah, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, I, as far as I can tell, you didn't stuff any of that up.
No,
at all.
Oh my God,
I
double checked
it. I'm sure
and
it's been extremely well figured out.
I would say even in the last week, just rereading a part, I was like, and I had that, you know, that cold yeah. horror. I was like, oh my God, did I get this date? Did I? Oh yes, it's all right. It's all right. I thought like, God, was he already, like, had he already, or whoever it was, died by the time, you know, like, you know, because it's going backwards. So yeah.
Yeah, it's going backwards.
I don't know who's going to be double checking me, but some people do double check that.
So some people
they
love
really do
to
they
find
love
those things.
To find
they love it.
Stuff,
yeah.
So.
We love them, those readers, don't we?
Oh, so engaged.
So we move 50 years back from Daniel, yes, and we meet who we know from the family tree and from context is his aunt Wendy.
Yes.
Is the next character we're introduced to. And again, characters that live in me like family, like, oof, Wendy, with me forever. Just give us a little brief idea about what's going on with
her.
So
we know from pretty much immediately Wendy's got some form of dementia, but early onset. So it's the year 2000. It's just clicked over. It's the day 2000. Remember, everybody was worried about the computers, you know, that
all the planes were meant to fall from the sky, everything. Yeah.
So she's clicked into that day, and that's the beginning of it. So it's just so that part of the novel is just one day in her life and how she's sort of experiencing that day. And I guess with Wendy, so she's, I think, around 60 in the year 2000. And with her, where I guess, you know, you're finding out what's real and what's not. So as she's moving through her day, and there's some repetitions because she's re-realizing stuff through the day. And then also with her, there's the question of where's her husband, like, all through it.
She's often waiting for him to come home.
Yeah, she's just,
and then realizing,
you know, but
he
does
won't
work
be,
every day,
why?
So kind of loses touch, I guess, even with what part of the day it is. And her daughter comes to look after her. Yes.
Yeah.
So that's that section with Wendy.
And again, just this intensely vivid portrait of a human, of a whole being. And even though she has got this early stage dementia and as we're dealing with this, her mind is so active and her inner life is so just beautifully rendered. I mean, she loses time and connections in there, but she notices everything.
Yeah.
And so we have this beautiful, beautiful, rich portrait of a full mind.
Thank you. Yeah, so I read a couple of books by a British woman, and I should have reminded myself of who that was before tonight. But she has dementia herself, and she's written these couple of books on living with, you know, Alzheimer's. And it was just really, so that was very interesting. And also, you know, like those, you know, the documentary, like, You Can't Ask Me That? They had a brilliant one. Mm. It just docos on living with people or the people with dementia. Just fascinating. Mm. So, that especially the woman, the British woman who writes about her journey with Alzheimer's, was fascinating and informed Wendy a lot. Just the realizing, you know, this British woman, just her realizations were very kind of generous and interesting.
Beautifully done.
What I wanted to say was she, like, if you read her books, she's sharp.
Yes.
Like, she's really sharp. Like, you know. And I don't know. I mean, she talks in the book about how she comes back and forth to her work, but then also how she'll leave something on the stove and her, you know, her daughters and blah, blah, blah. But she's really sharp. These are, like, great books, you know.
Yeah.
Well written. So it's not like, it
no,
also
I,
shows
I just,
you haven't lost.
It's so, yeah, it's so wonderful the way you've got this across, and anyone here who has experience with someone with dementia too and knows this, that it's there's gaps and there's, you know, slipped moments and connections, but the whole, particularly for someone older, that this whole life of experience is still there.
And what they remember and what they don't.
So beautifully done.
Very interesting.
So when we got Daniel, we got 50 years back, we've got Wendy, and then we go back 50 years again, and another absolutely fascinating, forever in my heart character of Ruby. Give us the quick snapshot of who Ruby is and what she's up to.
Okay, so Ruby is, she's about to turn 50 and she's in Hollywood. She is, so her mum, her father was Eurasian, her mum's full Chinese in Australia. She's moved there from Australia. She is based on a woman named Rose Kwong from the 20s. So Rose Kwong was earlier, and she actually, like, she was in her 30s or 40s or something, worked clerical kind of work, I think, and she decided, no, I'm going to become an actress. And she was in plays with Sir Laurence Olivier in that, and she became an Orientalist, and she was very big in Europe as an Orientalist. And I think Then she went to New York, and this is all during, by then it was during the war years. So I've got Ruby in Hollywood just after World War II. Anyway, so this Rose Kwong, like, there's some academic work on her. She was incredible. Like, she was an older woman and decided, I'm going to be an actress, took off, and, did well for herself. So, and I learned about her, actually, when I was doing my PhD on Asian, actual Asians who were in the Victorian London. So, and my supervisor gave me some information on Rose Kwong, who was an Orientalist, like I said. But the interesting thing about Rose Kwong was, I think, like Ruby, she'd never actually been to China. So she was full Chinese. But, and even in the 20s, she'd never been to China. I think she went as part of her Orientalism. So I just find it really fascinating that she was sort of in Europe teaching Chinese and about the Chinese, but she was actually from Australia.
Yeah.
So I just found that really fascinating. Yeah. And so I gave that to Ruby. Yeah. So Ruby's doing the same thing, like going around being very Chinese. In a world that was quite racist, so
being a particular kind of Chinese,
playing the game. So she's in Hollywood and she's trying to get parts as, you know, the bit parts as, well, of course, there was Anna May Wong, who was big, well, as big as you could become as a Chinese actress. So she wants to be like her and get the bigger Chinese parts. Yes, so she's on the, she's like, this is my last audition. If I make it, great. If I don't, then I'm going to go to translation work.
And she also, we should mention, we don't know straight away and leave everyone to discover what her particular connection is within this larger family, but so, she is living with her sister, who's
also Josephine Wong, who also, is an artist. Yeah. And Josephine Wong's mentioned in the, at the beginning, there's a Wikipedia page. I'll just quickly show you the Wikipedia page about the Chinese bush ranger. This page is based on an actual Wikipedia page of a Sam Pu, his name was, and he was an actual Chinese bush ranger in the 18, I feel like he was earlier, like he was the 1820s or something. Oh, couldn't be 1820s. 18, I feel like he was older than Ah Yang, but he, and he was executed, like he was, he went on a rampage and was executed, and it was the same as this format, like it was about him, and then there's a picture of him, like in a newspaper, but from like 40 years after he died, so it's not an actual picture of him. Anyway, so this picture, my son, who's an artist animator, he did this picture for me of my Ah Yang. So that's the sort of rendered page of him. Now, where was I going with this?
Josephine's mentioned Josephine,
also
that.
Josephine's the artist of, for him.
Yes.
What I've tried to do with each section is, so come to Wendy's part, inadvertently, I wanted each section, even though it's one book, I wanted each section to kind of be able to be read alone, actually.
Yes.
So even though Wendy's section is Wendy's section, there are hints in there about why Daniel might be the way he is. And then in Ruby's section, there's something revealed in there about what something in Wendy's section. So that's how I wanted it to kind of unfurl.
Yes.
So you're sort of having this idea, going back to why it's backwards, and I'm sure you're going to ask
me that soon. Yeah, yeah. Sorry about that. No, no, please keep going.
I love that idea of, you know, like Taylor Swift talks about her Easter eggs, you know, like you get one song, or she had those songs in, you know, Cardigan and something else, and they were, and the listeners, her fans would listen to them and go, oh my God, that song is connected to that song. Yeah. And Tim Winton's,
The Turning.
So all those sort of, books that, Yossi's Homecoming, I think it also, it goes forwards though, but they're kind of linked short stories, like you can see where this family's going from Africa to America.
Yes.
So I love the idea of that sort of thing. So I thought going backwards gave it this energy, I guess, where you could maybe even go, well, that's not great behaviour, and then something, and then the next section, if you make the connection, you go, oh, well, you know, like, so you sort of learning more about how it might have actually been, or why the character acts like they do.
Yeah. So
it comes later.
family saga going forward. What's going to, where's this family going to end up? You're sort of like explaining.
But it's like people.
Why that way,
but it's
right?
like people, you know, when you get a cranky person at the cashier, just actually, if you knew that they'd had a terrible day or somebody in their family was really ill, you know, like it's that kind of going, oh, she's a cranky bitch. And then later sort of, you know, if you knew, if you could go back in her story, you'd find out why sort of thing. So that's kind of another reason I went backwards. So we could have these little reveals.
Yes. Very beautifully done. So this is a good place to just sort of finish off this kind of setting it up, that the last section in the book, the fourth section, we start with a character called Maria in 1900. But then it's this real, I mean, I noticed the glowing Guardian review of this, put it a really wonderful way, which is that there's this sort of unfurling, and that diagram at the front, that family tree, it becomes this living organism. In this last section. But I just thought that was a great way to put it, because it's exactly what you're talking about, that it's when we get to this last section, so I don't want to talk too much about that in depth, that we do understand all these things, that even though they're 50, 100, 150 years in the future, we really start to see how that all, you know, took root in that first section. I thought it might be nice here to actually get you to read two little sections. So one, just to show everyone here who hasn't had the luck of reading the book yet, something of what this scope is.
Okay, so this is the very beginning. This is Daniel in 2049. The great storm of 2049, deep in the warmest of winters, quite destroys the lone Long'an tree. Late in the morning, when Daniel Connolly steps out the door, his gaze finds the toppled tree and he thinks, well, of course. He feels a crease of disappointment, but it's a mere fingerprint in a pie's crust, one of the many dimples pressed into the soft dough of his soul. Such difficulties are to be bridled, are expected, in fact. He's fortified by the smaller things, such as a dawn drive out to the bay to watch the sun throw its light across the dark blanket of the sea, or finding a perfect puzzle piece of porcelain, or taking that first sip of tea as he crosses the kitchen. Little actions that calm the spirits bid him to go on. He shivers as a descendant of the furious winds that transformed the fibro-cladding of his cottage into a resounding shifting wobble board in the dead of the night rustles through the acacias, a reprieve from the damp heat that spawned down from the north the day before. The temperature returned to something more akin to the winters he remembers from his childhood, although even then it was never so cold that he'd needed more than one extra sweater. His knees click as he crouches beside the great hulk of the fallen tree, a green Lusitania listing in the sea of yellow grass, snapped at the base, no chance of salvage. He's surprised at how comparatively slim the trunk is, concealed beneath a billowing crinoline of foliage. No wonder it hasn't withstood the storm. No wonder it hadn't withstood the storm.
Beautiful. And yeah, if you could just read us a little bit from one of the characters we haven't introduced that's in that later section where it's all unfurling.
This is Lo Pak. So Lo Pak is a Chinese gardener in North Queensland. And he actually, I don't know if anybody's read Stone Sky Gold Mountain, but he's the gardener in Stone Sky who lives. So Ying has gone to him in Stone Sky to get some veggies for the shop. And he's planting a Long'an tree. And she's astounded that he's planting something with the idea of staying and not going back to China. So that's Lo Pak. And Lo Pak is now in this one, which, talk about my maths before, like when I worked out, I was like, oh, my God, I can put Lo Pak in this. So
expanding the Mirandira universe.
That's right. So Maytown is from Stone Sky Gold Mountain. So Lo Pak, 1878, North Queensland. They're not going to run you off, are they, Mr. Pak, says Mrs. Porter from across the counter of the Maytown post office as she slid him a couple of coins in change. Absolute disgrace, that whole business was. Thinking a man of your years could do such a thing. Lo Pak smiled and nodded as though he didn't understand her well and carefully went down the post office steps. He squinted out into the dusty sunlight. He'd been in Australia long enough for English to have taken root in his dreams and negotiations. Since he was a gangly youth, in fact, when he'd learnt from the Scottish gardeners at the station to squat by each rose bush and rub the aphids away with a damp thumb, to dust the leaves of lime trees with ash and sulphur, to fence tender seedlings away from rummaging bandicoots. But he'd discovered over the years that it didn't hurt to allow people to underestimate his abilities, like one of those spiny fish that pretended to be a stone. And although just the week before he'd been acquitted of the vicious attack on his neighbour Sophie, the police had not yet identified the culprit, and he was well aware that most of the people who sojourned in this discordant, rackety anthill of a place, English, Chinese, Scottish, Irish, would continue to spy on him suspiciously, their views narrowed as though peeping through the cylindrical confines of a hollow bamboo stalk. It was time to leave. A pity, really. He'd hoped he'd finally found somewhere to settle. He sold his plot, complete with his windbreak of salt bush and rows of sweet potatoes and onions and cabbages, to Wah Chong's nephew, who would continue to supply his uncle's shop. But Lopak eased the young Long'an tree from the soil and wrapped it in a damp sack of earth to take with him, for it was in the planting of the Long'an seedling that Lopak had first felt he'd found a more permanent home. He would take the tree with him, transplant himself and the Long'an somewhere new.
Thank you. So thank you, because I think it's just good to get a sense, for people to get a sense of the scope that we, these two men that we've just heard little bits of are connected, and we don't know how yet, but the tree is there as well. So what I want to know more about, you've talked about doing the family tree and doing all the maths.
Yes.
Did you start with one of these characters and branch out as you thought of connections, or was this always a family that you started to sort of think about the emotional currents that you were going to people?
So I think originally it would have stemmed from the Stone Sky research, and I was interested in those cross-cultural relationships that happened in the 1800s. Mm. That I read about that were like a Chinese man and, say, an Irish or English woman, and they'd run pubs and blah, 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 and have 10 kids. And I found this really interesting diary a woman had kept of her family. She'd made a memoir. And so her husband was Chinese and all the kids are Eurasian, about 10 of them. This is the 1850s. They ran pubs and everything. And not once. And so somebody was doing, I think it was somebody in their family, and they were doing a thesis on it. Not once did the woman mentioned her husband was Chinese, which was bizarre. And I was kind of like Wendy, I was kind of like, well, was it because it was just such a nothing? Mm-hmm. But it couldn't have been because of racism, I guess. But then, you know, in the day, which I found out from Stone Sky Gold Mountain, there were four or five times more Chinese than white people in Queensland, you know, in North Queensland. Mm. So maybe it was just a natural thing and she didn't. But I feel no. And then I did some more research and I feel like a lot of people, you know, like there were cases of families hiding their Chinese dad in the kitchen kind of thing if guests came over while they were trying to pretend to be white, especially with the White Australia policy coming in. So what I wanted to look at was how these sort of patriarchal kind of racist structures affected people on a personal level. Mm. And then also, like, I went to the Immigration Museum in Melbourne and they have this almost reenactment recording of Chinese women who'd had kids here, but they'd have to go back and forth during the White Australia policy for a new visa, and then they'd come back and do that stupid test. Mm. But on the day, they can make it any language. They can make it Italian, French, German, anything, so they couldn't pass, you know, and then they wouldn't be able to come back in and get their kids. And there was a fellow in Cairns whose son went to China to get, you know, a bit of education in China and wasn't allowed back in, even though he was quite a prominent businessman in Cairns. So it was just, you know, so it's looking at how these huge structures affected men and women on a more personal level, I guess. So that's, and that's why it sort of goes into this sort of macro, you know, of those small, you know, the smaller, shorter, smaller lives towards the end of the book.
Yeah.
You know, because at the beginning, like in our day, they're just stories, like, you know. Like for Daniel, it's just a story. And for Wendy, she's keeping some sort of diary, you know, like trying to make a family tree kind of thing. But when you get back to then I wanted to show their actual macro stories that actually to them it's not just a story in the past, if you know what I mean. Yeah. I think that's why I sort of went like bigger, you know, like down to let's really look at what their lives were like.
Yes, how this has come to be.
Sorry, I don't even know what the question was.
No, well, I was asking about really where that started for you. And you talked about the research and the diary.
So I wanted to look at, and also I bang on about this all the time, but I've always been fascinated because I'm Eurasian, but first generation. Mm. And so I've always been fascinated. And, you know, and I was like the only Eurasian or Asian, or, you know, there were very few of us in the 70s and 80s in Brisbane. So, but as an adult, I'd meet these, you know, people who I thought were white Australian. They'd go, oh, yeah, no, my great-great-great-granddad was Mariba, was Chinese or something like that. And then you realise that white Australia policy period totally whited it all kind of out, you know, because I used to joke when Stone Sky came out because there were so many more Asians up there. I used to joke that, you know, if the white Australia policy hadn't come in, there'd be a lot more people who looked like me in Queensland, you know, like because they would have just settled instead of being sent home. Yeah. So I was just fascinated. So I had a Chinese man, and then the woman was based on, I feel it was my great-great-great-grandmother, Mariah Connolly. She married a Connolly, and she was a Mayo orphan, like in from Westport in Ireland, and they were sent here during the famine. So she kind of inspired the character who takes the last section of the book in the 1850s. So I did lots of, I went to Ireland, I did lots of research. They're very proud. They've got pages and photos of all the women who came here, the girls, they were like girls, to work as servants or whatever. And so, yeah, even that work, you know, the priest's little thing about her at the beginning, that's based on somebody's real one. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, a wonderful wonderful description from a priest.
That she's, of this woman, Mariah. She'll make a good wife one day.
Yes, summing her up, this 18-year-old in there. So maybe I would like to hear a little bit more about the different bits of research as you put this together as well, because, you know, you said before you wanted each section to read as a story on its own, which it does, as well as there being sort of an overall arc and a voice, but each section has such a distinctive voice, you know, from like Ruby in the 1950s in Hollywood, and then Mariah. So was that, I mean, that's your skill as a writer to create these humans that feel really real on the page, but where did the various research bits come into that as you put together each of those?
So I always knew I wanted each section to be quite different, maybe even in style.
Yeah.
So originally the third section was letters. It was Ruby and Pearl writing letters to each other, but it kind of was too disjointed.
And we have a few letters in there still.
Yes, I kept a few of their letters, but it was a bit disjointed on top of that last unfurling bit. So, and I wrote it, so I did write it, no, I wrote it, I wrote Daniel first, and his is kind of based on a real life murder. That's always fascinated me. Michael Robotham will know it when he reads it.
So that's the bit we sort of aren't saying exactly, but the thing in his past that is sort of keeping him to be a recluse.
That, because there's an aspect of that murder that's always fascinated. It's a murder from the 80s, I think, that's fascinated me. So it's not straightforward. And then I wrote Wendy's part, and I did a lot of research into dementia, obviously. And then I realised, I think before I could write Ruby's part, Ruby and Pearl's part, I needed to know where it was kind of going. So I did go to the last part and wrote. So Mariah's part in the end is actually you see her through everybody else's eyes as you go through the 50 years. Like, so things are revealed about her, but you're seeing the person's story, and she's like, something happens. It's hard to explain, but that was her section. Just so I knew where it was going, just so I knew what was happening to feed back into Ruby's section. And then I wrote Ruby's twice. I wrote it as letters and then hers. But hers was based on, and I'm just, you can ask Mum, I was obsessed with the golden era Hollywood growing up. That and Sharks and Ghosts. I had those, you know, those hardcover books you used to be able to get. Yeah. Sharks, Ghosts and Hollywood. Yeah. And so that was really fun getting into Ruby, you know, late 1940s Hollywood.
Oh, it's
that was
so,
at Los Angeles. It's just, like, it was really fun to write.
Feel
that.
It. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, that, I really enjoyed that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. It's so so lovely to sort of visit that place, and then and then again you feel these connections coming back to Australia and back to China and back to Ireland.
Yeah, because she's from North Queensland.
Yeah. It's wonderful. Having loved your writing and your work way back, wasn't that long ago. Oh, the Fish Girl, right? 2017.
You were so kind, yes.
The first time I came across your writing before I knew you, and then each of the novels since, and the short story collections as well. And to me, reading this, I feel like that your scale has sort of widened.
Right.
Not just because of the structure of this book, but what I was thinking about is, you know, again, from the start, from The Fish Girl, you are sort of recovering individual lives that have been overlooked in history, or correcting misrepresented lives. Mm. And you've done that so brilliantly in different ways in each of those novels. But this one, we've got this entire family, you know, spanning over two centuries, and the families sort of themselves representing these two significant waves of immigration to Australia, the Chinese and the Irish.
Mm.
I wonder if that's something going from sort of the one life, like our Fish Girl in story, to this sort of whole expanse of this whole chunk of history or several histories being woven together here.
Well, I guess though, the four, each of them are almost really how I would treat a novella.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
But don't repeat that, even though we've recorded it now. But I guess
but also then the connections are there too. So
Well, originally I was going to write it as connected short stories, actually, now that I think about it. I was going to write it like It's Raining in Mango by Thea Astley. That's actually my original impetus was to write it like that, even back when I was writing Stone Sky. And then it turned into the four sections instead.
Yeah.
And... yeah, I just didn't really want to write a family saga that just sort of rolled on. It's just not what I wanted to do. And I know sometimes when I'm reading those sagas, and there's some beautiful family sagas out there, but sometimes I get a bit confused. Not confused, but, you know, the characters kind of roll into each other. So I did kind of want that individuality too between the stories, like each character.
Yes.
Yeah. And a family tree, because it gets confusing.
Because you need the family tree.
The family tree. We did even consider putting the family tree in each section, like just at the beginning of each section. By the way,
it's so onerous to turn back to this.
By the way, we're up to this person. Yeah.
But also, I mean, it is nice to have it there, and I love a book with a family tree.
Yeah, right.
But I don't think it is really confusing.
Oh, good.
Except in the way that sometimes when you're sitting talking to your grandparents or your parents and all of that, and they'll talk about some third cousin, and you have to for a minute go, wait, is she the one who blah, blah, blah? And you kind of have a second of doing that and putting them into place, and then you're back into it again.
Right.
Because it feels like, you know, by the third section and definitely by the fourth, you're in this history now, or these histories.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's the individuality that allows that, because we remember these people so specifically as if we know them.
Thank you.
So I am going to see if anyone here has questions in a few minutes, and so just start thinking of those now. But something I do want to talk about here that kind of is really important in this story too is the idea of memory and the fallibility of memory, both, you know, the official histories, which is something you've always written about, but also, you know, you've talked about Wendy is literally losing parts of her memory. Mm. Daniel is very
carefully
guarding his.
Yeah, he's worried about how he's remembered.
Yeah. So you know, there's so much in here about both, again, on the bigger scale of a nation's history, but also how family stories are remembered, misremembered.
Yeah, that was on purpose. So, yeah, I did want it to be, I guess, because it's, you know, it's like memoir, or, you know, like this family.
Mm.
So, yeah, so we've got Daniel worried about, not worried, so Daniel's part is about how we are remembered, and maybe falsely or not. Wendy, of course. And then I wanted Ruby's part to be sort of, I guess Wendy and Ruby's parts bring in a bit of memorabilia. And, of course, Daniel plays with a lot of memorabilia. Mm. And then the last section is supposed to roll into, this is actually what it was like.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So we've got, oh, this is how we remember it. This is how the family remembers him or her. This is da-da. And then the last bit's like, this is what happened.
Is what happened. Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. It's really, really beautifully done. And I think too, also in the Ruby section as well, there's some deliberate changing of history as well in terms of what will be remembered.
Sure.
Again, without being spoiling. And that's something that goes through it too. And again, in a national level, in terms of the White Australia policy and immigration policy and things of
women
like
women were treated.
How women were treated. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
What they're allowed to do and not to do and that sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So the final thing I wanted to ask you about before I turn the questioning role over is the role of art in this book, an artist. Daniel is an artist. He doesn't self-identify as one, but he is one.
Yeah.
He says he potters around with these mosaics, these tiles. But
yeah, and they were inspired by something I saw at an art gallery. Sorry,
go on. Well, I mean, I want to hear all about that. But so Daniel's an artist. Wendy writes stories and is doing family history.
Sure.
Stories built out of her family history. Ruby is also writing a book as well as being an actress.
Sure.
Josephine is painting.
I
read it all and I thought, well, this is Mirandy appearing in her book here, taking all the bits of history from the past
and making
new stories out of it. It's not all just you, but these are these little bits of you coming in as the artist who's taking the shards of history and turning into something
new. Yeah, it's interesting because somebody said to me lately, because, you know, like Anna the Javanese, you know, that novella I wrote, they were like, oh, you like to write about art. Now, let me tell you, at my last launch for Sunbirds, I was laughing about it. So my daughter's just finished her honours in art history, got the uni medal today. We weren't there because we're terrible parents. And I was on an art tour just recently with these beautiful people there in Indonesia. And she was going along for her PhD and I saw the itinerary and I was like, can I come? Like, so I just like, dormed along with everyone else. It was brilliant. But I remember saying at my last launch, May, ever since she was like eight, like I think one of her first birthdays, instead of a party, we came down here to go to the art gallery here. And we went in, she was only about eight, and there was an older lady there to show around, you know, like the art pieces and everything. And May wanted to do it. And I remember bending down going, you know, it's going to be like for an hour. And May was like, yeah, like totally into it, but I am totally the person that you'll drag around the art gallery. I'm like, like just glazing over. But I do find them really inspiring. Mm. And actually, I think Frances said to me on this last tour, she came up to me on about the third day and said, so is this giving you some ideas for any books? And I was like, no, I don't really work like that. And by the fourth day, I was like, I'm going to write this and this and this and this. Yeah, yeah. So art and like even the Anna the Javanese though.
Yeah.
On a more sort of basic level, I'd written The Fish Girl and, you know, my other things. And Samantha, my cousin, she is an artist and she contacted me and she said, you know, Gauguin had like this model, you know, named Anna the Javanese and gave me some books, some Gauguin, those big books, and that's how that started. So you've got to surround yourself with people who like art or artists.
Yes.
Yes.
And shove it in your face.
Yeah, when you're whinging. And then you're just like, oh, I'll write something. That's how it happens.
Well, for someone who doesn't think that she's that interested in art, you also write about it really well. So just quickly tell us before we go to questions, the mosaic thing that Daniel's doing, you said that was based on something you actually saw.
Yeah, so I saw something, it was years and years and years ago and I was in Goma, I think, and there was an art piece there that was, it wasn't mosaic like his, but it was stacked. It was, yeah. And I remember just thinking, oh, my God, that can be Daniel's. Mm. That's what he's doing. And then I guess the shards and all that sort of thing came a bit later. And then so he makes these pieces of art where he smashes things and puts them back together again. And somebody did say in one of the reviews just lately, this is what a dingbat are. And these books take years to write, so you do kind of forget your impetus on things, you know. And somebody in one of the a lovely review said, you know, his works are like a representation of the rest of the book, like it's putting things together, right? And I was like, whoa,
that's what you've done.
I thought, did I think of that? Anyway, luckily I went back to my notes for this sort of thing, so I know what I'm talking about, and somewhere in my notes I've written, Daniel's works are a representation of, you know, like,
absolutely they
these fractured lives. And I was like, so I did know what I was doing. But then you forget.
you forget
what you're doing.
Even these genius impulses every day. I can't remember all of them. My goodness.
I never write down why either. I do remember because in my notes I have something like, this is from 3-4 years ago. It can go backwards. It can be in four sections, like, you know, spring, autumn, you know, summer and winter. But I haven't written down why I thought that at the time. Like, I've just written it in capital letters, but not what took me to that moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
but and then it just works so well. You and don't then, need to yeah, rethink just it, do it and to
until,
question it and
until I come to questions, and then I'm like, how did I come up with that? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes. And also there's great food, which we haven't had time to talk about, but there are always some beautiful food. Postcards up here with recipes from the book as well, which I think is a wonderful thing to have.
Cookbooks, yeah.
So recipes from Randy's family and the one of the elements, obviously, that's personal in the book.
Yes.
We will finish our conversation now, but obviously you are going to grab your pre-bought copies of the books or buy a copy, several copies, great gift, great book club book, genuinely. So many things to tease out and to talk about in here. I think maybe you need to create a cocktail with the long
ones. We are for my Brisbane launch.
Great.
Yes, we are.
So get the recipe for that. Make some of the recipes here. Have it for your book club. You mentioned Thea Astley's book before too. I reckon you could even do like a twin read with that.
Yeah,
great
actually.
Things in there. Lots of exciting opportunities. So buy multiple copies so we can have all these future events happening now. Talk to Mirandy.
Thank
but
you.
For now, please thank Mirandy very
thank
much.
Thank you, Emily.
And thank you everyone for coming out on a very cold, wet evening. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2026 season. Please remember to explore our extensive podcast archive, where you'll find a wealth of interviews. I'm Greg Johnston. Keep reading, keep listening. It's so good to have your company, Imagining the Past.